I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. As of yesterday, there have been 62 homicides this year in Kansas City, Missouri. That's 15 more than this time last year, a 32% increase, and with no indication that things will slow down. And homicides are just part of the problem. After steadily dropping through the 90s and 2000s, assaults are on the rise, and instances of rape and robbery have both risen since 2015. So why can't Kansas City solve its crime problem? It's certainly not for a lack of trying. Today we're looking for answers, and we want to hear from you. Later, Bill Brownlee with this week's Local Listen. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. What's going on in Kansas City when it comes to crime? The city has already recorded 62 homicides so far this year. That's up from 47 at this point last year and 34 in 2015. This comes on the heels of yet another triple homicide last week in the 7100 block of Monroe Avenue. But homicides aren't the only crime category seeing a bump in 2017. Crime stats for the first 3 months of the year, the latest available, show increases in every category of violent crime. That means rape, robbery, aggravated assault, stealing, auto thefts, and arson. It's a grim set of findings, and it comes as the U.S. economy generally is getting better and unemployment is dropping. So what's going on? And why do we talk about this same issue year after year? Can Kansas City ever get a handle on its violent crime problem, which makes this town one of the country's most violent? Here to talk about it are Rashid Junaid. He's the Violence Prevention Manager for Aim for Peace, which tries to stop violence before it occurs. Rashid, always good to have you here. Welcome back.
Thank you, Steve.
Professor Ken Novak is also here. He's on the Criminal Justice Faculty at UMKC. Ken, good morning.
Good morning, Steve.
Deidre Anderson is Executive Director of United Inner City Services, and she served on the Kansas City Citizens Task Force on Violence. Deidre, good morning to you.
Good morning.
Rashid, what's going on out there on the streets? What is it about 2017 that's making Kansas City more dangerous than usual? What are you seeing?
I don't know if it's more dangerous than usual. I think
Well, the numbers say it is.
I think people have always been shooting. They may just be hitting their target now. So there's continuously been the level of violence, but I think that people are more hitting their target. I think there's more availability of weapons, high power weapons in the community as well.
Do you see anything else happening that's causing what appears to be an increase across every category of violent crime?
I just think that people don't know how to resolve their conflicts without discussing things. I think it's interpersonal conflicts. A lot of times when you even look at the police reports, it's an interpersonal conflict or argument that started the situation, and a lot of times they don't even know each other. It's like their first time meeting. We had the shooting on Holmes, a road rage. People just meet each other. They don't know how to get along, and then they exchange gunfire, and people get hurt or killed.
Professor Ken Novak, what's your sense here of why Kansas City often makes these lists of the country's most dangerous cities? What is it about this town?
It's a very difficult question to answer, but to your point, Kansas City has historically had a higher rate of violence than many of its comparator cities. So what we're seeing right now is, sadly, nothing terribly new. A lot of the factors that influence violence, the economy, poverty, jobs, things like that, we know Kansas City struggles with across a lot of those root cause factors, but so too do other urban environments. And so trying to understand why Kansas City and the St. Louis's and the Milwaukee's and Chicago's stand out from some of their peers is rather difficult to explain.
Deidre Anderson, do you have any insight into that? What is it about Kansas City?
One of the things that I notice, my career actually began in Kansas City doing child welfare work, and then I was in the Hickman Mills School District trying to help address prevention issues at a school level. A significant number of the crimes are being committed by people that are under the age of 30. They're disenfranchised. They're lacking hope and they are struggling to figure out how they fit in our world and in our city. And
you've seen it with your own eyes.
I've seen it with my own eyes. I see it. I see the emergence of, we're a preschool. I see the emergence of violent behaviors with four-year-olds. And I think that Rashid said it very well when he said, people don't know how to resolve conflict. And I think some of the things we used to do in schools because of, you know, Common Core and focus on academic achievement, we've forgotten that before you can learn, you have to feel good internally to be able to sit down and do the ABCs and 1-2-3s. And so I think a lot of it has to do with disbursement of resources away from some of the core things that our young people need in mm-hmm. order to leave school prepared for the world.
If that's the case, what do we need to do about it, Rashid? How do you begin to address this inability to deal with conflict? What do we do?
I think it has to be a mass education effort in terms of understanding how to resolve conflicts peacefully. One of the things
we done that already?
No. I don't think we have. I think we've, like she said, we've pulled those things out of the schools. They're not present on a regular basis as a part of the curriculum. And so we see a lot of conflicts even happening in schools. One of the things I see that Deidre and them does, they're teaching the young people from the ages of, 6 weeks to 5 years old, conflict resolution. Those are the types of things that people have to know from the very beginning.
You're saying that is happening now.
At St. Mark's, mm-hmm. but at other places it needs to happen in schools and YMCAs and Boys and Girls Clubs and throughout this city. We have to begin an education effort. Anytime we want to change behavior, we have to educate to that change. And so we have to continue to deploy people out. Aim for Peace, that's what we do as a part of our program, but our resources are limited. Mm-hmm. But we as a community have to say this is unacceptable, marshal those resources for people, enable them to be able to resolve their own conflicts, because we're not going to be there all the time. The police not going to be there. Aim for Peace is not going to be there. But we have to enable the community, saying this is the behavior that we want you to exhibit as a responsible person in this community to resolve conflicts.
So it should be part of the curriculum in every high school in this city?
It should be a part of the fabric of our community.
Yeah, that's interesting.
You know, the churches, the schools. It can't just be one thing. It has to be all of us. And as we go forward, like the Violence Free KC and other efforts that we have underway, we're trying to collaborate more so we all singing the same song. One is too many. We have to resolve our conflicts through mediation, discussion, as opposed to bullets.
Yeah. Ken Novak, you're an educator for a profession here. Does this all resonate with you? Does this make sense? Or how do we go forward here?
No, absolutely. The two things that resonate the most with me that Rashid and Deidre were talking about is the lack of conflict resolution skills that I think a lot of people have, especially young people. And I think that a more structured environment where those types of skills can be strengthened, learned, and whatnot would go a long way. There's a culture of violence, I fear, in Kansas City that may encourage violence as a dispute resolution tactic. That needs to be explained, that it's not acceptable by the community, by the schools, by mentors and whatnot. And the other thing is disenfranchisement. There is a general disenfranchisement amongst many people within the city, whereas if you reasonably don't believe that you're going to live past 25 or 28, then it's really difficult to convince someone to set long-term goals. So people are much more likely to live in the moment, and very often that moment creates violence opportunities. And I think a lot of violence are crimes of opportunity.
Well, this is discouraging. This notion that Ken Novak just used this phrase, Rashid, culture of violence. You know, you get a sense from reading the crime stories in The Star day in and day out that's exactly what this city has, a culture of violence, particularly on the east side.
Yeah, especially when you think about culture, that's what we do right now. And obviously what we do right now is we kill people when we have a conflict. So yes, it is a culture of violence in Kansas City. Yes, we call it Kansas City, but on the east side they call it Killer City. And this is all in their rap songs and the things that they're doing. They refer to this as Killer City. And we don't want to be known as Killer City. We want to be known as Kansas City. And we have to get back to that and begin to change the norm that exists on the east side. But all through Kansas City, because it's not just happening on the east side now. We see it spreading south.
South to where?
all over the city.
Mm-hmm.
Homicide, a triple homicide happened on 71st and Monroe.
Right. Yeah.
That's not the East Side.
Right, right. You know, this notion I want to come back to here, that what is it about Kansas City? Ken, you were saying, you know, sort of saying there's not really an easy answer to that idea. But, I mean, is it the fact we remain so segregated? Is it the fact that there's a lack of development on the East Side? Are we too spread out for our police force and for Aim for Peace to effectively focus resources? A lack of police officers?
I think all of those could be contributing factors, particularly Kansas City's history of segregation and economic and racial segregation along the certain corridors within Kansas City sets up a history of violence. And, you know, that's what we're talking about here in terms of culture. Culture isn't just created. Mm-hmm. It's developed over decades, over centuries, over generations, that this is normal. This is the way that we solve disputes. This is what we can expect from the next generation. And I think that that foundation of economic and racial segregation within Kansas City plays part of a role when it comes to identifying solutions to that problem.
You know, Deidre Anderson, when you served on the Kansas City Citizens Task Force on Violence, did this notion of a culture of violence come up in your meetings and your deliberations? And what did you make of it? What was the response to that? Help me there.
It did come up. I think that one of the things that I think we have to recognize is we can't legislate or police our way out of this problem. And I think that the one thing we haven't talked about at all is community and neighborhood. And without a sense of community, without a sense of neighborhood, who is my neighbor? Many people don't know their neighbors anymore. And I think you have to look at what we have going on in our education system here locally, with nearly 50% of our children going to charter schools, where they're being bused all over the city to schools that are not right up the street from them. In our history, schools have been the place where community meetings happen, where people organize, where right. they got to know their neighbors in a different way. That isn't what Kansas City looks like anymore. And we have to say, okay, what is our new normal? And how are we going to adjust to this shift in the way we deliver education so that we can create community in a way that is different than it used to be? And many of us want to hold on to what it used to be and not accept that we have progressed and changed as a city. And it doesn't matter whether you like, love, or hate it. The reality is that's our new reality. And I don't think we have adapted as a city to do that. And I think that whether that means the local church that is in the neighborhood of the charter school helps create some sense of community, I just think that there's an erosion in things that community was. When we talked about the culture of violence on the task force, and as a person who works very closely with people that are struggling with all kinds of things every single day and sees the power and strength of families and people who want to do good and want to make a difference in their community, and they're overlooked and they're not listened to by other places, that is one of the things we also need to do. Is we take festivals and let's just use that as an example. How many big, huge, community-engaging festivals do you see happen on the East Side? Not very many, because we say it's too dangerous. Well, how are you going to change the blight and the crime that you see in a neighborhood if you don't ever just invest in and spend time? And festivals are not the only answer, but they are a great beginning.
You're saying that one thing that's holding communities back these days is this notion that people don't know their neighbors because they're afraid to go outside their front door. Is that one factor here?
I think that's some of it. But I mean, when you look at the predominant presence of renter-occupied renter occupancy in a lot of neighborhoods, and it's a revolving door of neighbors, that's one thing. Homes associations are not always friendly to renters. The way we have invested in supporting homes associations, that's evolved and changed, and the city's neighborhood investment looks different than it did 20 years ago when I moved to Kansas City.
So that's why you said that you can't legislate or police your way out of this, that maybe at its foundation we're talking about this need for community that has to spring up organically, it sounds like.
Right. You know,
and
Rasheed's
nodding his head as I'm asking.
Block parties and, you know, just different things that bring people together, but it also takes knocking on the door. Some of the things that Aim for Peace does, like the only way you get to know your neighbor is when someone's courageous and bold enough to come knock on the neighbor. And neighbor, you know, you got a new neighbor, bring them a cake.
Yeah. Does this community stuff resonate with you, Rasheed?
I think so. The police chief, Daryl Forte, the past police chief, he talked about that broken window thing. And it had a lot to do with how people see themselves in the community. If I walk outside and I see piles of trash, I see the house next door that's vacant, that bothers me. My children don't have any type of hope because they like they're living in a war zone. And so we have to clean that up and create that environment that they feel comfortable, that they feel valued, that they feel like this is home. And a lot of people are paying rent. They're paying $750 rent to stay in a $30,000 house.
Mm-hmm.
They could have their own home at that type of money, a $100,000 home for that type of money. And so we have to look at how people are positioned in the community and put them in the best position so they can prosper. We talk about the payday loans, but the home ownership is terrible on the east side. So the people don't own anything. So if you don't own anything, you don't value anything.
You know, as you're all talking here and we're talking about issues like a culture of violence, we're talking about lack of home ownership, high numbers of renters, we're talking about lack of community. You know, it's pretty easy to get discouraged here because these are big, intractable, meaty problems. How do we march ahead and begin tackling these kinds of things?
One of the things we recommended on the task force, which was one of the things I suggested, is there needed to be a hub in neighborhoods of community resources, of places that people could go, where community could begin to be developed, where residents would have a place that they could go, where they could begin, like community action centers, where they could begin.
Or maybe a church?
It could be at a church, but the neighborhood needs to determine this is the place we want people to go. A lot of people don't want to go to church. I mean, so that's not always the place. And you know, you have many different faiths represented in our city, and one church may not be open to the Islamic or the Muslim faith. And so the reality is you need to look more broadly. We tend to always want to go to the same type of place to do things. Maybe it's an old house that's abandoned that needs to be renovated and turned into a hub of positive activity or a place where people can go. You know, one of the ways you change the culture of snitching is you give people an opportunity to have a trusted place where they can go to share what their concerns are about their neighbor, about whatever, as opposed to, you know, sometimes we want to say, well, you just need to go tell people. Well, that's not an easy thing to do when you still have to go live in the house, in the neighborhood, one or two houses down the street where all the illegal activity is taking
place. Did the Task Force on Violence adopt that recommendation?
We adopted it and the mayor accepted it.
Is anything happening on that front since the report came out?
I'm not sure.
Yeah. Ken Novak, weigh in here again about this level of discouragement when we have these big, big, tough issues like this. I mean, people want these days, they want simple solutions. They want folks like you to wave a magic wand and to say, here's the magic bullet, here's all you have to do. But with this problem, that doesn't seem to exist.
Well, violence is an incredibly complex issue, and the knee-jerk reaction is to find a quick fix. And very often, that quick fix relies on something that the police do, cleanups, roundups, aggressive enforcement.
More
and
officers,
like
fewer officers, whatever the, yeah.
Right. And those some strategies that the police can initiate can give the community breathing room. However, it's not a long-term fix. Even the broken windows type of approach where you're aggressively enforcing petty crimes is not a long-term fix because it runs the risk of leaving the community feeling alienated from their police or feeling that the police are a standing army. Mm-hmm. Or once you start aggressively enforcing jaywalking, drinking in public, or all these types of social ills, can you stop? Can you stop doing that? And has the community been able to take root in a lot of these core problems, economic, housing? Once you stop policing in an aggressive way, what do you leave behind?
Yeah.
If it hasn't been seeded by a lot of the things that we're talking about here?
Well, let's do this. Let's take a break. And when we come back, we'll continue our good conversation here about how Kansas City can get a handle on its violent crime problem. We're looking for your solutions, your ideas. The phones are open. 816-235-2888 is our number. Again, 816-235-2888. You can tweet us at KCUR up to date. We'll talk about the need for more police officers, if that goes somewhere, what NOVA, Aim for Peace, Mothers in Charge, and other groups are doing. And again, we'll take your phone calls too. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And we are back. I'm Steve Kraske. Yesterday, we talked with a Lenexa high schooler who's developing technology for early detection of Parkinson's. You heard me right. Lenexa high schooler who's doing that. Also, singer-songwriter Boz Skaggs discussed how he makes music meaningful. You can listen to those conversations at kcur.org/up-to-date. On tomorrow's show, how the Kansas City Public School District helps students deal with traumatic experience. In the story of Operation Breakthrough, the Metro's pioneer in early education services to impoverished families. That's tomorrow on Up to Date. This hour, we're talking about how Kansas City will ever get a handle on its violent crime problem. The city perennially ranks among the top cities in the country as the most violent in America. We have a great panel here talking about this. Rashid Junaid is a violence prevention manager for Aim for Peace. Professor Ken Novak teaches criminal justice at UMKC. And we're also joined by Deidre Anderson, who was on the Kansas City Citizens Task Force on Violence. Our number here, 816-235-2888. Deidre, one of the recommendations that came out of your task force was to hire a coordinator to sort of work with all these disparate groups around the community to help focus on certain goals when it comes to ridding the city of violence. Tell us a little bit about that.
What we knew going into it and what we looked at even closer was that there are lots of things going on in Kansas City, but many of those groups are not talking to one another. They're not aware of one another's focus and initiative. And so we recommended that a position be dedicated to working with all the various groups and pulling them together in a meaningful way that would lead to some positive change. So that recommendation was accepted by the mayor, and the money has been allocated in the budget. I'm not certain where they're at in the actual hiring for the position.
You know, Ken Novak, just to offer some context here, the city has done a lot in recent years to be more proactive about crime in some dramatic ways. The police department has targeted crime hotspots in attempt to crack down here. Leaders developed a Kansas City No Violence Alliance, it's called NOVA, in an attempt to aim the resources of multiple agencies at the crime problem and to provide services to people who might be prone to commit violence. Rashid is with Aim for Peace that tries to stop violence before it occurs. You know, on paper, all this seems to make a lot of sense. Why aren't those efforts paying greater dividends when we seem to be acting in a proactive way here?
Yeah, and each of those strategies are proactive, which is a huge step in the right direction, because historically, a lot of what we've done in the criminal justice system has been simply reactive. So those are really good strategies. What I'd like to use a sports metaphor here, which I know is sometimes dangerous. Each of those are different plays in a larger playbook. And each of those plays can be drawn up very strategically and implemented under certain circumstances, but they still need to be implemented. And if you're a follow football and whatnot, plays sometimes work, sometimes they don't. Sometimes they work under certain circumstances, sometimes they're less effective other times. But one common aspect is that very often a play, if we're using the football metaphor, requires a lot of different moving parts moving in the same way in a certain time in order to be successful. Sometimes they work, sometimes they don't, but it's important to go back and review, just like football players do, review the film to see when does it work, under what circumstances, and why.
You know, Rashid, trying to put myself in your shoes a little bit, it's difficult for Aim for Peace, and one of these efforts we're talking about here in the proactive category, you know, to point to a set of numbers and to say that we stopped 28 homicides from occurring last year because you can't prove you stopped anything from occurring. So does that make it difficult for you to prove your case as you go before city leaders each year?
I think that that has been a burden put upon us at times. But we look at data in terms of if there's a baseline in a particular area, say, for instance, seven homicides in a particular area, and if we deploy 10 people in that area for 2 years and we see a reduction, and we've worked case management with 40 people in that area, and those are the top, and mind you, we're working with the highest risk people who recently released from prison, somebody who's involved in gang activity, a shooter, somebody who's been shot. So those are the types of people we're working with. So if we've done that type of work, then we know through that work mm-hmm. and those numbers that we've made a contribution. Did we do it all? We can't claim it all, but we know we've made a great contribution when you see a dramatic drop in the homicides. We put that high concentration of work. And so who can really say that? Can the police say that? They
right.
do, but
right.
but who can really say that? And we're always put on the spot for that, but nobody else is. And so be fair
yeah.
with everybody. So when we're having good times, we have low homicides, people hold a press conference and say, look what we did. But when it's high, it's like, are you really being effective? But that kind of question needs to go around the table as well.
We're looking for our listeners to chime in here with their ideas for how to crack down on crime in Kansas City. 816-235-2888 is the phone number. Let's go to Rick from Independence. Rick, you're on with a good panel here. Good morning.
Yes, good morning. I've been following this issue and studying it for quite some time.
Go ahead.
I would urge your panel to have some open forums and hear the voices of the youth today and hear what their problems are and learn what their despair is. I've done so. Our youth today have no future. They look at those of us that are established. We have futures. We have retirements. We have something to look forward to. And they don't. They have no opportunity. And no future to look forward to. And it is a culture of despair. And if you look very deep and study the issue and the core problem, it is the corporate exploitation of our entire society. And it's getting worse by the year. And if you look at the income disparity, you can see that very vividly.
Right. Rick, thank you for the good call. What about this idea of focusing on youth and providing more opportunities where none exist today? Dieter, what did you guys talk about when it came to that?
Well, let me tell you something I actually did that actually we saw dramatically impact in the Hickman Mills area while I was there. We had a coalition of youth. To Ken's point, we had youth, and it was called Youth for Change, and there was an organizer that brought the youth together, and they worked in helping us to solve their own problems. Instead of us saying what the answer was, they told us what the answer needed to be.
And what was the answer? What were some of the answers?
Some of it was they did some social norming, and they put information out statistically about all kids are not violent, so we sometimes want to say everyone is violent, and that wasn't necessarily truly the case. They did organize community block parties. They came up with events and activities they wanted to see. They learned how to advocate with their vice principals about things they wanted to see going on in the schools, and we listened to them, and when we could, we implemented their ideas. When we couldn't, we went a different direction. But historically, we have always thought of youth as violent. This is like nothing new. And we have got to learn to paint a more positive picture about young people because they do often feel like their futures are not bright and that it's hopeless and that nobody wants to listen to them and everybody misunderstands them. And it's very true. I can remember being a teenager and feeling misunderstood. But if we want to see something change, we have to see them truly as everyone says, they're our future. Well, do you really believe that? Do you want to spend time with them? Do you want to actually see them be listened to?
Yeah. Does that make sense to you, Rashid, as you get out in the streets a little bit?
I believe a lot of them, they don't have any hope. And the caller, he kind of hit some of those points. There's a sense of despair. They don't see themselves in the future. And so they live their life as if they don't have a future.
Which is a completely different mindset from how you and I are living.
Right. They just see themselves in the moment. as those young men that were killed on Monroe, they saw themselves in the moment. They were rappers. They were in that type of field. That's how they saw themselves. They didn't see themselves as being doctors and lawyers and successful people. That's the lens that they view themselves in and the accomplishments or the ceiling that they see them reaching.
Let's go to Sabrina from Kansas City, Missouri. We're talking about Kansas City's violent crime problem. Sabrina, good morning.
Good morning. I was calling because I wanted to comment on segregation in Kansas City.
Right.
I've lived in several parts of the city, and the one thing that's very striking is how you just walking out two blocks, you're in a completely different neighborhood. And, you know, we can't expect these kids to not notice that the ones that have less to not notice that the kids down the block have something better than they do. And with the way the school system works, some of them don't even have schools that they can go to in their own neighborhoods. If you look at the North Kansas City parks, you'll see like the North Kansas City School District is just awful. And then you go a couple miles and Park Hill High School and Park Hill South is one of the best school districts, and it's just heartbreaking to see that. And we can't expect anything more than violence from those kids.
That's, I was going to say, Sabrina, the impact on kids when they notice those differences is what? And that's part of life, right? It's part of my life all the time too. How does it impact kids?
You mean how does segregation impact kids?
Yeah, when they see that some kids have a lot more than they do.
I feel like it has to do with how much the city is willing to put into certain neighborhoods. So in Parkville, because the income there is higher, the roads are better, the schools are better. And in that spot, it's like, oh, because your parents are poor, so this is what you're going to get. I feel like the city can do more for them and go in and fix the schools up and get computers in there and make extracurricular activities and do some daycare for parents who have to work three jobs. Those kinds of things. I think that the city, we shouldn't just leave them to, oh, well, if you worked a little hard, then maybe things would be so bad for
right.
you. And you know, lend a helping hand and kind of support them. And I'm not talking in ways of gentrification, because that's what I see keep happening downtown and 18th and Vine. I feel like we should give resources to the people
right.
in the neighborhood. We should set up programs like my husband and I.
I got to scoot on here. But listen, I appreciate your comments very much here, okay? Thank you. Let me go to Greg from Midtown. Greg, you're on the air.
Yes, I'm a real estate broker and investor, and I work a lot with minority businesses. And one of the things that I've noticed, you know, and I'll use RGS Construction. I just did a lease with these guys. They're fabulous. They're African-American minority business owners who were super happy that the GO bond package passed because they're employing a lot of people and growing their business. And I see a real need, not just for, you know, the doctor, lawyer, college path, but for the construction trade path and
right.
for the entrepreneurship path. And recently, Steve, you had the piece through entrepreneurship author on.
Right.
And honestly, applying those same principles with Kauffman being the number one in the world entrepreneurship foundation funder and a top 10 foundation in the world, just to me, that's what's most lacking is jobs. And I think there's many paths for Mark Jones and his partner at RGS. That path is owning a small construction company that's now going to be really prospering because the city, although Freedom opposed it, Freedom Incorporated opposed it,
mm-hmm.
nevertheless, in their own community, they disagreed with that. They worked for the passage of that because they understood how important that was, that infrastructure economy was to employing them and a lot of other people.
Greg, thank you very much. Appreciate it. Let's keep moving through some calls here. Leanne from Kansas City, Missouri. Leanne, you're on Up to Date.
Thank you. I have a question more than a comment or suggestion.
Sure.
It's my understanding that some social scientists, public health professionals are approaching the issue of community violence as a public health issue and are treating it and addressing it in the same fashion as any other epidemic. And I was wondering if your panel had any comments or information about that, and I'll take your responses off the phone. Yeah. Thank you.
Leanne, you are preaching to Rashid Junaid's choir here. He's with Aim for Peace, and that's exactly how they look at crime.
Exactly. We're modeled off a program called Cure Violence. It was formerly known as Ceasefire Chicago. And so it was put together by epidemiologist Gary Slukin. And so it's looking at it from a public health approach. They're looking at violence as the disease is being transferred from one person to another through witnessing and copying. And so we look at violence as a disease, and we begin to interrupt its transmission and begin be able to work through those processes of changing the norms of that violence.
Ken Novak, again, you study this from an academic point of view. This notion of violence being looked at as a public health concern, does that make sense?
Oh, absolutely. And I do believe it's a public health care concern. And I don't think that violence touches all parts of our community and our population in the same way. I think it is focused disproportionately amongst minority communities, particularly young Black males. Young Black males have more than 15 times more likely to be killed in a violent act than the general population. So it's concentrated amongst certain populations. And violence can also spread like diseases. And what Rashid was talking about earlier about dispute resolution and what we've seen from violence as a way to resolve disputes. When somebody is connected into a violent network, when they or their friends are engaged in violent activities, which includes using a gun, they themselves are far more likely to be a victim of a gun crime moving forward in the future, not unlike the way that doctors may approach diseases and how diseases spread. There's absolutely empirical evidence that suggests violence spreads in a very similar way. So why not examine crime and crime control policies from that lens? That makes complete sense.
If Mayor Sly James was with us here today, and he's been on the show any number of times talking about the easy availability of guns as a major source of the problem here, he's so frustrated, in his words, with the General Assembly in Jefferson City for not cracking down more on a gun control kinds of issues. The mayor says almost anyone can get their hands on a gun almost any time they want to. Help me, Rashid. Does he have a point? Is that going to solve, an important set of steps towards solving some of this?
I think it has the guns have a big effect on the level of violence and the intensity of violence. The availability of guns definitely has an impact on the violence in Kansas City. But also, that's the reality. So now how do we work beyond the reality? Because nobody's going to repeal that law saying everybody can carry a gun.
Not anytime soon.
So how do we work around that? I think that if somebody put some crack or cocaine on this table right now, none of us would be like, what is that?
Right.
So we got to create a group immunity saying violence is not acceptable. Even if you have a gun, you keep it holstered.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when you have a conflict, you talk it out. You don't pull your gun out. So we have to create this sense of this is how we act with a gun.
Yeah. Let's go to another phone call here. Philip from Midtown, who voluntarily gave up guns, is giving up guns. Philip, fill us in on what you're doing.
It isn't that I voluntarily.
All
I've
right.
never had one. But as a defense lawyer, I have a little different perspective. I not only see on TV the mothers of dead children who died of gun violence, I also see the kids who have perpetrated that violence, who get hauled off to life or prison, and their grieving mothers. I would suggest that one of the things that we should do as a society is if you have a young man living in your household and you know he has a gun, take that gun and throw it in Troost Lake. If we fill Troost Lake, if the mothers of Kansas City filled Troost Lake with the guns that their sons have around the house, we would have a lot fewer gunfire deaths in this city. And I think that would make a big difference. It's not enough to say, oh gosh, I feel bad, I'm grieving. You need to take proactive steps to stop the gun violence.
All right, Philip, thank you very much. Ken, I'm wondering again from an academician point of view, as you look around other cities around the country, have other cities come up with solutions or approaches that you sometimes sit back and think, man, I wish Kansas City was thinking about doing X or thinking about doing Y?
There has been a emerging evidence base of, you know, best practices, what works best. And Cure Violence had experienced a significant impact in Chicago. And so it makes sense that that type of play from the playbook could be implemented elsewhere.
Although Chicago in recent years has been just incredibly awful.
Absolutely. Whether that is has any relationship to that particular approach or not, I think would be premature. Mm-hmm. A lot of the strategies that Kansas City is continuing to develop, you mentioned hotspot policing as well as focused deterrence. Those strategies are amongst the best evidence that has reduced violence in other cities, and it's being implemented in one way, shape, or form in Kansas City. The sustainability of a lot of those approaches becomes very complicated, especially when you're talking about a cultural change. Those are approaches to reduce violence, perhaps in the short term, but what Rashid is talking about is a change in the culture and in the norms. And I don't know if those evidence-based practices will change culture, but they can help change part of the culture.
Okay. Back to some calls here. Let me go to Joe from Leawood. Joe, you're on Up to Date.
Hey, Steve, thanks for bringing a much-needed story to the airwaves. Just wanted to pass my gratitude and thanks to Rashid and his team of violence interrupters for just showing bravery in Kansas City's, some of Kansas City's most neglected zip codes. Rashid, you got any counsel out there for the average Kansas City and how they could be a part of greater solution to address violence issues? Taking it offline. Thanks, Steve.
Yeah, thanks, Joe.
I think that we all have a responsibility to educate about how we should conduct ourselves when we have conflicts. And I think each one of us have to be that mediator, that person saying that violence is not acceptable. And if we're all singing the same song, I'm pretty sure we'll have a different result. But I don't think we're not extroverted enough in that particular mission to get that done. And I think we have to be more vocal about how we feel about violence in Kansas City.
You know, the other issue, the question you hear raised oftentimes, Ken Novak, is this idea of the city just hiring more police officers to keep better watch on what's going on around here. Make sense?
It does make sense. I don't think that necessarily is a cure-all. I think it's not just about how many police a city has, but what they're doing. The number of police from city to city, and you know what the magic ratio is of what a city should have, you can increase the size of most police forces significantly. But if officers are not engaged in proactive types of practices that will discourage crimes and violence, then it really doesn't matter. I think the what we've seen from enforcement size or police staffing sizes is that by adding 50, 100 officers and having them simply do the routine types of patrol and calls for service isn't going to get you to reducing violence. So it's not how many cops you have, it's what they're doing.
That's interesting. I should point out that the city is already spending 75% of its general fund budget on public safety, and by that I mean police, fire, ambulance, municipal court, 75%, so you wonder how much further we can go with that. Next Tuesday, I should point out, KCUR debuts the new series called The Argument, looking at the many reasons behind the high rate of homicides the past few years in Kansas City, Missouri. Well, we're out of time here. I want to thank our callers today, and I want to thank Ken Novak from UMKC for coming in. Ken, thanks very much.
Thank you, Steve.
Rashid Junaid, again from Aim for Peace. Appreciate all you do.
It's been a
pleasure.
Thanks
very much. And also Deidre Anderson with the Kansas City Citizens Task Force on Violence. Thank you all very much. KCUR contributor Bill Brownlee is back with this week's Local Listen, and he wants to talk about my brothers and sisters. How are you, Bill?
I'm well, thank you.
Who are my brothers and sisters?
My brothers and sisters are a big family. We've got 9 or 10 people in this collective based in Kansas City. They play jazz, blues, rock, psychedelic soul, a little bit of everything.
It's a big sound.
It's a big sound, and there's a lot going on with it.
We're going to hear it right now. This is the group My Brothers and Sisters, the album Violet Music from Fall, Winter, Spring, and Summer and in 2013.
If you don't ask why in the situation, you'll be caught spinning round and around till you don't know how long you've been there. Who's to say what you'll do to get through when you got no job and a hunger for family? You push a person so far.
That's My Brothers and Sisters, the track Fall, Winter, Spring, and Summer. Bill, big sound going on there. What do you like about them?
I like that there's a string section back there, if you listen closely. We have the horns. There's that groove. There are going to be some backing vocalist singing gospel style in a moment. I love that giant stew of sounds.
How many people are in this group? Like 94?
It seems like 94. And when you're on the dance floor at one of their shows, you know, it seems like you're enveloped by, you know, musicians all around you.
These guys have two shows this weekend. Am I right about that?
That's right. They play Friday at the Record Bar. They headline the late show at that club near the Sprint Center. And then Saturday, they open up. No, actually, they're the second band on the main stage at the Boulevardia Festival.
Wow. You said that this group has made a pledge when it comes to Friday's show. So what should the audience expect there?
Yeah, you know, the band's leader, Jamie Cyril, is prone to purple prose. And he says that it's going to be a surrealist art pop dream party. I don't know what that means. But I do know
Sounds intriguing.
They're one of the best live bands in Kansas City.
I understand they're sharing the bill on Friday with a real up-and-comer also from Kansas City.
That's right. Anyone who heard Gina Kaufman on Central Standard yesterday heard an interview with a man named Stefan Singleton. He is associated with My Brothers and Sisters. He'll be opening Friday's show, and he is a star in the making. He's a terrific arty R&B singer.
A group again, My Brothers and Sisters, Bill Brownlee with this week's Local Listen. Bill, always appreciate it. Thanks very much. You can follow us on Twitter. We're at KCUR up to date, and follow me at Steve Kraske. Tomorrow, the story of Operation Breakthrough, the local early education provider for impoverished families in our community. Our program is produced by Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, Coy Duggar, and Marlia Campbell. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.